Okay, this is once again the interviewer is Evan Falkenbury. I'm interviewing Dr. Cleveland Sellers Jr. Today is March 19th, 2013, and we are in Denmark, South Carolina, on the campus at Voorhees College. So the first question, Dr. Sellers, in this part two of our interview, can you describe arriving in Mississippi in 1964, and specifically to discuss SNCC's activism in Mississippi from your perspective before the 1965 Voting Rights Act, so that about that year or so, okay. If you were there before that.
All right, I want to just step back the year prior to 1964 in the summer. Mm-hmm. SNCC had what was called a freedom election, a voter election. And what we were trying to do, we centered around, I think the title was Freedom Vote. And what we tried to do was we tried to find candidates in Mississippi that would run in a mock election, essentially what that was. And so Ms. Fannie Lou Hamer, I think, ran for senator, and a number of other, Ms. Annie Devine ran for something. There were a number of people who ran for office. And the idea was to indicate to both the Democratic and the Republican Party that that Mississippi citizens, African-American, were interested in being a part of the political process, and that the only reason they were not a part was because they didn't have the right to vote. And so that mock election was actually set up where they brought a small number of students in to help with the elections, and that the elections consisted of having the candidates on the day of the election go to a church, which would be a polling place, and actually register. So they mobilized a lot of folk to actually participate in this mock election, and I think that was the genesis for moving to 1964, where you would get a larger group of young people to come into Mississippi. And you could address many of the ills that existed in Mississippi, certainly discrimination, but the absence of the right to vote, the educational issues, the health issues, and all those kinds of things kind of would come together around the Mississippi summer 1964. So going into Mississippi in 1964, the summer, there were students from many of the Ivy and the more established liberal arts colleges, mm-hmm. who actually got the call probably in January about coming to Mississippi for that purpose. Right. Hey, how you doing?
I'll start back up. You're good.
Okay. And so the idea was to get these college students and to put them in communities and actually have them work on this new idea and tactic, and that was to challenge the seating of the regular Democratic Party. The Democratic Party said it was inclusive and it was, you know, you talk about the liberal wing of it and all those kinds of things. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party wanted to go through the same parallel processes, similar to the mock election, in getting a delegation prepared to go to the National Democratic Party's convention in Atlantic City. Mm-hmm. And that was the key and the cornerstone of the Mississippi Summer Project. In the process of doing that, we would have some voter registration activity, but we knew that we weren't going to get very far with that. Mm-hmm. We thought that it was very important for us to register for the political party, as many people as we could, and use that as a petition to the Democratic Party, saying all these people signed up, but they were denied opportunities to be a part of the Democratic Party. Plus, the regular Democratic Party voted Republican in 1960, and the entire Democratic state went with, I think it was Goldwater, mm-hmm. In 60, and that there were other examples of the Democratic Party in Mississippi violating policy of the regular Democratic Party. So we wanted to make the case for that whole thing. The other parts of that was we wanted to address the issue of the education of African Americans in Mississippi. And so we did a kind of parallel school. We call those the Freedom Schools, mm-hmm. in which we actually had master teachers out of Boston and other parts, California, in those classrooms teaching, and the beginning of the process of teaching African-American history. Mm-hmm. And that was fun because up to that point, you know, there had been a celebration of Black History Week, but there was no real concentration within the status quo, even within the African-American community, to build on that history, do the research, you know, get it into books and actually make it available. There was some, but it was limited and restricted. So we figured that we could kind of break out of that while we were breaking out of the shackles that denied us the opportunity to register to vote. The Freedom Schools, the other one was creating a method in which we could actually provide some preventive medicines, and we could actually do some procedures and that kind of thing to help kids primarily with the kind of afflictions that they were going through. There were the diseases that you find in third world countries that were very common, mm-hmm. scurvy and other diseases that were directly related to poor nutritional intake, mm-hmm. and so we wanted to attack that issue too. So we were able to organize the Doctors for Human Rights, who then brought in nurses and doctors, and they would go into the project areas and actually set up a clinic and have people come in, especially children, to find out what kinds of issues that they had to address in providing some preventive health education in those communities, and also providing some remedies to some mm-hmm. of the young people who had issues with their health. I remember a case of shortly after 1964, when many of the doctors returned back to their respected areas after the summer of 1964, set up in New York doctors for human rights, the Doctor Committee for Human Rights, I think is what it was called, or the Medical Committee for Human Rights. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Hamer went up, and she was getting an exam and hadn't really had that kind of access to medical attention in Mississippi. And Ms. Hamer had a limp, and she thought that she was, when she had that checked by a doctor, I don't think he even looked at it, but he said that she probably had polio. So she was under the impression that she had polio. When they got to her, to the doctor in New York, she found out that some way she had broken that ankle, and it hadn't been set back properly. And she, for some almost 30 years or 40 years, this happened when she was a child, because it had been that way for such a long period of time, they couldn't repair it.
Right.
And they said that it would have been a simple process of re-breaking the ankle and then mm-hmm. setting it right. And, I mean, she just kind of boo-hooed about that, because she always thought that her limp was directly related to polio. And the diagnosis was not only faulty, but they were it created a situation for her that she didn't have to go through. So that gives you some ideas about the level of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now, I went to northern Mississippi in the Delta, which is the area that most of the African Americans were located in, because mm-hmm. that was the farmland, the heartland, of Mississippi and where the larger plantations were.
Right.
And we did have what we call Freedom Days, and that's where we had a number of people that we would find that were interested in registering to vote, and we would try to get them all together on a particular day, and we would go with them down to the polls to see if they could be registered to vote. So we had those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But much of our time was spent in communities organizing these newly registered members of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And when I'm talking about organizing, the first thing you have to do is get a form, get it filled out. Mm-hmm. Then you have to bring people together at some place,
right,
in order for you to explain all of what the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was about and what it was trying to do, and the procedures for getting delegates, certified to go up. And that would be going to the precinct meetings, going to the district meetings, going to the state meeting, and electing delegates as you go up so that those delegates would actually represent the whole of Mississippi at the convention. And one of the things that we were able to do with that is we were able to get a professor from the from Tougaloo College as the lone white delegate, but we had a diverse delegation going in. And this is in 1964, the shackles of segregation were still pretty much entrenched, even though the Civil Rights Bill had been released in the June of that period of time. But
right,
2 months later, we had this diverse group that went up to Mississippi. Now, the state had prepared, because they knew that we were going to have this Mississippi Freedom Summer,
mm-hmm,
and they had prepared, but their preparation was almost like a military preparation.
Right.
And so they just hardened, bought tanks and new guns and tear gas and all that kind of stuff. I don't know what at that point they thought was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But and so they deputized everybody in every county, every white person in every county that they could deputize. And so they had pretty much militia, posses, that kind of operation going on. So we knew it wasn't going to be easy. And when Sherna Goodman and Cheney came up missing, we had certain security precautions, mm-hmm, that we had in place and procedures that we had in place. And so they didn't utilize any of those things, which simply indicated to us that they were dead. And so even before the orientation was over, Bob Moses had to go in and address the volunteers who had not gotten into Mississippi yet,
mm-hmm,
to the fact that the people who were just there a day before were now dead, and that people who were going into Mississippi and knew it was going to be pretty hostile, they had to make a choice now, because it's no longer the threat, it is the reality that somebody will actually lose their lives. And so during that summer, we ended up with a total of six people who lost their lives. All of them were young people. One was from Holly Springs, Mississippi, mm-hmm, on my project,
right,
and Wayne Yancey. And in a mysterious traffic accident that nobody still can explain.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had two young people that were found down in, I think it was around Natchez, but in southwest Mississippi. They were found in a river. One had the upper tarsals of the body, and the other one had the lower tarsals, or some kind of disfiguration, but they were able to identify who they were. And I think a couple of years ago, 2006 or 2007, they actually tried the person who killed them. They finally, they had identified him early, but they finally got through the federal, the FBI's effort to open cold cases they were able to convict, but you're talking about some almost 50 years after this has taken place. So, well, at least 40 years after. But those were some of the deaths that were caused during that summer. And you had somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 arrests of various and sundry volunteers and local people and all that kind of stuff. You had roughly, I think it was about 52 house and church bombings or burnings during that summer. You had all kinds of incidents that really made the experience very traumatic for many of the folk who were involved in this Freedom Summer activity and process. I think it was a transforming kind of experience that changed the lives of all the people who were there and who were involved. Never to go back to being adolescent, never go back to being the innocent kind of bystander, always feeling a need to continue to fight for democracy and freedom and justice and equality for all. And I think that was the same thing for many of us in SNCC. Now, we were able to, in the second district, register the most members, have the largest number of freedom schools, effective freedom schools. We even organized community centers and recreation activities in these rural communities. And had health clinics set up with nurses and doctors in those facilities. So if you go back and look at it, the area that needed to be the most productive was the area that was the most productive. And we also had the local meetings of the party, and we had the precinct meetings, and et cetera. Mm-hmm. One of the things we found was that the Democratic Party would actually advertise publicly where they were going to have the meetings. So they would meet the letter of the law for the Democratic Party, the Mississippi Democratic Party. And what they would do is they would change and send out a communication to everybody to meet somewhere else, maybe on the same day, but not at the place they have set up. And that was for the purpose of not having us come into their meetings and ask for inclusion in that whole process. So we documented all of these things. We actually had the ballots, the registration forms, we had the ballots. We went down to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and we got the car that Sharona Goodman and Cheney were in. Mm-hmm. We also got the church bell from the church that was burned down. And we also put together a pretty quick a committee that saw the reconstruction of that church in that area. And that was a kind of like the first time that Bob actually got down there. They had a service in the burnout church, and you could see people actually sitting on chairs in that church, not giving up hope and not losing the faith. And that was real critical for many of us who were very young, and sometimes our faith would and hope would kind of fade. And folk in Mississippi said, "No, you got to keep going." And these were folk who didn't have very much of a material kind of wealth or basis. These were people who said that you had to be able to dream. You had to have that hope and hope in a better future and having that faith. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that I think were tremendously important to us moving forward. Right. And then we got these things. Matter of fact, I had the truck with the bell. We put the bell on the top of the truck and the car on the back of it, and we drove it up and we put it on the boardwalk at Atlantic City right next to the convention center so that people could actually see that history, and we also had the ballots there, and we had everything that we needed to have, and we thought that we were going to put together a delegation that would make the case. Certainly Ms. Hamer and Ms. Annie Devine and what's her name? Blackwell and a number of other Steptoe and a number of other legends in their own time in Mississippi strategized, and we went from one process to the other. When we first got there, we started letting the delegates fan out and actually meeting delegates from other areas. And we thought we had some sympathizers until we found out that party politics are devoid of morality. And so it's power politics. Sure. And we hadn't thought of it that way. We're still kind of in this idealistic world that if we could show that what we represented was the good versus what the Mississippi regular Democratic Party represented was bad, evil or ugly or whatever, that the National Party would just rally to our position. And we went through that whole process with having Lyndon Baines Johnson had Hubert Humphrey take the responsibility for negotiating this and getting this done. And then Humphrey delegated it to Mondale. And that's one of the reasons why I think that even as each of these people come and move through this process, Mondale was not successful, I think, because in the back of a lot of African Americans' mind, his role in the trying to get the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to consent to a victory of two delegates at large.
Right.
And we had a session there when that proposal was made at a church somewhere in Newark. I don't know where the church was. But we did go, I did go, and they had a marathon meeting, and they brought all of these civil rights and civil libertarians and all to this to tell the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party they should accept this
right.
as a token. I mean, you have won.
Right, and two seats
at large. Mm-hmm. That means they could be anywhere. They could be in New Jersey, and they probably were going to be in New Jersey or New York or Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
But the delegates heard all of this, and then after that was over, they came together, and they talked about the struggle over the summer. The summer in Mississippi was very much parallel to the summer in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had enemy fire, you had attacks, all these kinds of things happen on a regular basis. And we did what we call Watts reports. This is where you had the Watts lines, and you could actually report in, and we could actually, from the Atlanta office, get information and collect information because the Watts line was in Atlanta. And so we have these reports of all the incidents that occurred during that period of time. It's yay thick.
Mm-hmm.
And it reported on all the incidents of arrests, all the incidents of harassment, all the incidents of shootings and beatings and all those kinds of things. So we had a comprehensive record of all that data. We were a little ahead of our times. We had security set up with our automobiles that included CB radios, citizen band radios, and those things worked most of the time. And they did provide security to a number of people who, if they had not had those CBs, would probably have gotten caught out in the dusty roads of Mississippi,
right.
never to be found again, or found again, not alive. So we did all of the things that we could possibly do, and many of the delegates had been a part of that process. They, Fannie Lou Hamer was SNCC, so there wasn't a difference. So when she is looking through that, she says, now we've come a long ways, and we have a lot of pride and we have a lot of dignity, and we don't think this is a victory. And we don't think that there's been any compromise at all.
Right.
I mean, we propose that we have all the delegates, and you come back and say, you can't have any of the delegate seats. And so they said that what we will do is we will vote not to accept that, and we'll go back to Mississippi, start over again. And that's what they did. But before they left to do that, they all came the next night to the Democratic Party convention, and the Mississippi delegation had gone on back to Mississippi. They were through, and so the seats were open, and so they got tickets to get into the building, and then they just went and occupied the seats for the Mississippi delegation. Eventually, they were rousted from that, but they did have an opportunity to sit in those seats, and that was a moral victory for many of those individuals that took it on to be involved in other political campaigns in Mississippi, and to get a chance themselves to get the power to run for office themselves. So that's the way that whole process went. But it was, for the staff, it was very disappointing because we had put people at risk. We had used every ounce of energy that we had to get a documentation of the atrocities as people attempted to register to vote or even go to a precinct meeting. And none of those issues were considered. The issue that was considered was what kind of impact that would have on the Southern Democratic delegations in the future. Now, there are some benefits that come out of this, and that is that the Democratic Party later would say that in 1968, that all of the Southern delegations had to be diverse, and that included women as well as African Americans. So there were some benefits. And that's the first rung, I think, on the road to having the opportunity to have Barack Obama elected president in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
All this groundwork, all this footwork, all this suffering and sacrifice actually created the and started the process for that to happen. There were a lot of other things in between, Shirley Chisholm running and and Jesse Jackson running twice, but the beginning of that is Fannie Lou Hamer getting on the floor of the assembly and testifying and raising questions about, is this America that I live in, and why is it that I seem to live in an apartheid society in Mississippi that's supposed to be a part of America. And so that's the way we connected those dots. And very shortly after that, we began to have some questions about the agenda of that liberal labor coalition that was built around the 1963 March on Washington. And pretty much about a year after the March on Washington, that coalition began to kind of tear apart, because we had said very specifically what it was that was our goals. And many of those people who were a part of that March on Washington came in to ask the delegation to accept the compromise. The other was that the question of the interests of the Democratic Party, whether or not that interest and the interests of the African-American community were in sync. And I think that the conclusion was that it wasn't just the Democratic Party, but the two political parties, their interests weren't in sync with that of the African-American community. And so SNCC, suffering what we considered a tremendous defeat, began to reassess and retrench with the idea that we needed to come up with some kind of way in which we empowered the African-American community. Mississippi was a clear example that you're not going to do it through the Democratic Party. It'll be a paternalistic kind of relationship right. with the Democratic Party. We would never win. And they would actually begin to set the tactical devices that we would be appropriate. And we felt like we needed to have that power to determine how it is that we secure the freedom. Right. So we began to look at that and began to work on that. By this time, 65, I had become program director of SNCC. And we were looking at the possibility of organizing independent parties that were independent of the Republican and Democratic Party. So now, when we began to look at that, we were no longer just the labor and liberal opposition, but now the Democratic Party, which is labor liberal, was a little concerned about the direction that we were taking. But nevertheless, we kept pursuing that. And Jack Minnis, our research director, actually found this Civil War law that said that in Alabama you could organize a party in a county.
Right.
And listed what the process was to do that kind of thing. And so we got Stokely to go into Alabama. He was in Mississippi and headed up that project, and he thought it was best for him to come out of there because there was a lot of frustration and anger about what had happened, and he needed to kind of get himself back on the ground and in the field and organizing. And so he went to Alabama. And one of the things I had to do was there were a lot of resources that were coming in for the Mississippi Summer Project. But after we challenged the Democratic Party, a lot of those resources began to dwindle as they began to see the alienation take place between the movement and this segment of the movement. We're talking about young people in SNCC and the established movement, the traditional movement types.
And can I ask a more specific question about that from when you were the program director for COFO, for Council of Federated Organizations, and when you were at the Holly Springs site.
I was project director.
Oh, project director, excuse me. Mm-hmm. When you were in that role, can you describe the ways that you raised money for SNCC and the ways in which you fundraised, the kind of outside resources that were coming in? Mm-hmm.
First, there wasn't that many outside resources coming in. Many of the young students that had come down were asked to bring what funds they could. And our survival, if you have to talk about survival, was directly correlated with the level of work we did, because then the community would provide the meals and transportation, and every now and then some gas or whatever it is they could actually provide. There was not, on our in our area, a lot of people leaving the area to go out to raise any monies. They could write home to parents and ask the parents to set up a little something and maybe raise a couple of $100. But we were working on shoestrings. We were working without resources. During that period, the pay was up and down. Sometimes you got it, sometimes you didn't. And it wasn't but $9 a week. So, you know, it wasn't any money there. A lot of times, we would, working in Mississippi, you would work for about 2 months, then you'd go over to Atlanta and maybe eat a meal at a restaurant and maybe go to the theater, and you had to stay in a hotel usually. You went to the Freedom House there, but if you were trying to get out of the Freedom House, you'd just want to go to a hotel or someplace like that. And then you probably have to borrow money to get back to Mississippi. So, I mean, there was no groundswell of money that was coming in. And that, like I said, that money as soon as the Democratic Party began to feel like we were not in lockstep, they began to cut the funds. And that's one of the reasons why you had the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, which is what we called it, become known as the Black Panther Party.
Right.
Because it was in the interest of the Democratic Party to make any independent political party illegitimate. And they thought that they would make it illegitimate by making it something that was violent and all those other kinds of things, something that was very narrowly nationalist and and those kinds of things. And so we the press was much larger than we were, and that segment, the Democratic Party, had influence there, and so they actually were able to describe this new organization coming up as the Black Panther Party to try to scare people away, including African Americans, certainly supporters, away. And so we continued to pursue that. One of the things I had to do was to find resources. And so we got in that project, we got the most seasoned SNCCers in that project. And they understood what they had to do. They had to do work. They had to entrench themselves in those communities. Right. And they had to find ways in which they could actually live in those communities and survive in those communities. So Lowndes County was like that. And then Greene County. And then I forget what county Selma's in. Dallas County. Those three. And there was one other. It was four of them. I can't remember the other one right now. But we put people in those areas that had a tremendous amount of experience. And a lot of them were people out of that NAG group also. Right. So they were kind of around to kind of move this the needle again, as had happened in Mississippi. And my responsibility was to juggle that so that we weren't taking away from somebody else to provide resources to Lowndes County. And it became a priority for me because I understood the efforts to create a new model that would talk about building, well, talk about empowerment, but also talk about building an independent political process that would achieve some degree of Black power, and then can negotiate with all the other entities, whatever they may have been, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, just with segregationists who said that, okay, for this county where you are in the majority, we are willing to concede this if politically if you concede that, you know, we and so we just thought that that was a breath of fresh air coming into the movement. We were going to create these new models. We had a lot of energy, and we wanted to just go forward with that whole process like that.
Let me ask
ask your questions about that period, whatever.
Yeah. One more quick question about the finances. With SNCC in more general terms, did they receive funds from the Voter Education Project, from VEP?
We received funds from the Voter Education Project early on.
Okay.
But those funds even dwindled
and
dried up. You know, Mississippi was a pivotal point.
Yeah.
And it was the kind of christening for SNCCers.
Right.
We had conceded the tone of our speech at March on Washington. And this was a time when we had to make a call, and we decided that we would stick with our principles and stick with our values, because that's what the Mississippians did.
Right.
And so that gave us the kind of maturity to be able to make those kinds of decisions. And then from then on, we said what we meant, and we meant what we said, and we continued to move forward in that light, that we weren't waiting on somebody, and we were going to try to look good and make somebody else feel good. It's whatever we thought and we came up with and researched and concluded was the best method in which we could actually get the empowerment and then moving on to identity and kind of politics those things became very important to us.
So you've talked a little bit about the progression of your involvement in SNCC in 1964 into 1965 into the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. So can you describe or talk about, because you joined SNCC at a young age, and then quickly you were in a position of leadership. So can you describe how it was that you became a leader within SNCC so quickly?
Well, I think that like going into Mississippi, I had already had the experience of the March on Washington, had the experience of Cambridge, had the experience at Voorhees, and so when I became a project director in Mississippi, I worked very closely with the organizers in Mississippi, and that's where most of our organizers were. And then I began to have communications with the organizers in Georgia and Arkansas. So we had all of these folk who pride themselves on the fact that they had organizing skills, they understood community organizing, they understood how you build organizations for change, they understood the kind of sacrifices you had to make, and those kinds of things were the key ingredient. And I kept trying to bring that group together. I think that that's how I managed to get the support. And I represented a new entity, the program director's position in SNCC. And I was also not quite in the camp of John Lewis. So what we were doing was we were getting ready to move forward and organize the influence of the organizer into SNCC, so that it wouldn't be the national office, you know, just making decisions without having the input of the field in. And I think I kind of campaigned on that idea, on that notion that we need to have a voice. We're the ones out here, and a lot of times in areas where there's little or no communication, you know, somebody has to at least be considerate of what's going on. And, and when there's shifting around resources and all that kind of stuff, we thought that that group needed to have not only voice, but also treasure. And that we felt like, you know, when there were new cars purchased that and distributed, that those people who worked in really hostile areas should have the fastest and the best automobiles. That was just a given. And there was no way in the organization that that was being done. And a lot of the functions of the project, I mean, of the program director of SNCC, were early on under the aegis of the executive secretary. And we thought that needed to be separated out so that the field staff would actually get, like I said, influence and recognition and voice in the operation of the organization. That's how we ended up going to Alabama. Right. If we'd have gone through the other process, we probably would have stayed with something that was going to go maybe to Alabama and talk about getting Alabama into the Democratic Party.
Right.
Same kind of model that we used in Mississippi. But we learned each time around. Every time we made that kind of step off, we learned. And we transformed the organization and transformed ourselves and kept it moving. Because after we go into Lowndes County and begin to build the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, we also have this discussion that actually comes up during the summer of 1964. About Vietnam. And then we are organizing in Alabama, in Tuskegee, voter registration drives, trying to get people to register to vote. And one of our very dear friends, Sammy Young, is killed down in that voter registration campaign. And at that point, we talked about the fact that he was a veteran, and he had a Purple Heart. And how is it that somebody who's gone to Vietnam come back and get killed in America fighting for the democracy they claim to be fighting for in Vietnam? So as soon as he was killed, you know, SNCC folk came together, and I think it was Gloria House and some others sat down and drafted the anti-Vietnam War statement for SNCC. Right. And so that comes out even before Black Power. And some people get that all convoluted and twisted.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And not only does it talk about that, but it also talks about the statement, the anti-Vietnam statement, talk about our relationship, our efforts to relate to those who are struggling against apartheid in South Africa and freedom and justice in the Congo. And so we brought all of those struggles into the mix. So we were beginning to make that shift, that transition from a civil rights to more human rights to even an international kind of struggle. And from that broadening of the language in terms of our dialogue, we also began to talk about liberation, because we began to see some parallels between the colonial kind of setups and regimes around the world that people were fighting against, and a Watts Harlem, where you had the same kind of parallels. And so the whole notion about liberation comes out of that. So now we get from January to the Mississippi Meredith March, and then Black Power comes out.
Right.
But a lot of people leave out the Vietnam and assume that the Black Power thing is some kind of very narrow nationalism. We don't like white folk. And we had to battle that not only with the outside world and those who were trying to condemn us based on that kind of fact, and by some people who were members of SNCC. We also had to battle that inside of SNCC, because there were elements in there that wanted to have us kind of camp out on that very narrow kind of perspective. We were never for that, so we were willing to fight, and so we fought that off as best we could.
So there were some within SNCC who didn't want to become more internationalist in thinking or address the Vietnam War?
No, they wanted to, because SNCC did, but when it got time to talk about Black Power, they wanted to revert back to this little white, you know, white-black kind of analysis assessment. If you're talking about international struggles, you pass that narrow, you know, kind of skin color, I guess ideology, if you want to call it that. And what I'm saying is that we were at that point when we talked about Black Power as opening that up, but there were some tactical things that we thought were important. One is that we didn't want to give it definition so that the status quo would then sit over here and just take that whole thing apart. Like when the civil rights movement started out, and you talk about Brown, if you want to go back, that there was talk about equity. And somewhere down the line, somebody figured that equity was not going to be something that would, you know, meet the satisfaction of your resistance. So then we began to talk about integration. And the movement seemed to have gotten caught in talking about integration and lost the talk about equity.
Right.
And it took us a long time to get out of that. So we said if we can say that what we want is Black Power, and we want to give people an opportunity to express and articulate what that is, and then we'll pull it all together and talk about what Black Power is. But simply, it's empowerment of minorities and African Americans. That's what it is. And we immediately began to work with Hispanics, immediately began to work with Native Americans, immediately began to work with groups in Mozambique and Rwanda and South Africa. And so we were moving in the direction that we were talking about it, mm-hmm. and people who understood us and knew our history also saw that evolution. Mm-hmm. But what was happening was in the press and with some folk around, mm-hmm. they were just targeting in on Black Power so that that would kind of be an obstacle that would not allow you to go down that path in the manner that you needed to get down that path. So we had to fight that struggle within SNCC. But we did have some SNCCers that went out and they concluded that we had kind of forced the whites out and didn't appreciate what they had done. I'm thinking that's unfortunate, and a lot of that has to do with how we all left SNCC, mm-hmm. as opposed to any kind of plan of action to do that kind of thing. There were three votes. None of those votes put whites out of the organization, and then Stokely left, I left, and some other folk left, and then we're talking about 1969, then there is a vote. Right. To say that all whites have to go, but by that time there's none there. And even at the time when the first discussion came up, there wasn't a lot of whites there because a number of whites who had been involved understood that it was important. If you're talking about creating the beloved community, and that beloved community is going to be made up of whites and blacks, then somebody has to organize a white community. All we're doing is organizing an African-American community. That's all we did from 1961 all the way through to 1968.
Right.
So let's be real. Don't tell me that we're going to have that, not unless somebody's going to go over there. Now, I can't.
Right.
Okay? Now, I can train and help and let you work as an understudy and get all the skills and all that kind of stuff, but at some point, you have to go and do that kind of thing.
Right.
That hadn't happened to this day. I mean, you had some instances where you had mobilization, but you haven't had organizing of fundamental communities of whites, right. who saw the similar interests that African Americans experienced. Now you can go to places like West Virginia, mm-hmm. and they know about food stamps. So when people are referring to the food stamp recipients as being less than, mm-hmm. they feel that pain. Mm-hmm. But you have to organize folks so they know that you have to bring those interests together, mm-hmm. without having that color thing, which has divided us for centuries, being the booger bear to keep you from actually bringing those interests together.
Right. So within SNCC, when the debate is intensifying over whether whites should remain in the organization, mm-hmm. or not, there was that case when Bob Zellner, I think, wanted to organize whites in New Orleans.
Right.
But that was met with some fierce resistance. Did that event and then larger events around that, I guess that was in maybe 67 or 68, is maybe 67.
That was 68.
Was it later?
Yeah.
Was it 68? Mm-hmm. Was that sort of the more of the dividing line?
That was the dividing line. When Bob made that statement, it probably was Bob, Jack Menes, Bob's wife, Dottie, and maybe one or two other people in SNCC at that
point. That's about it.
That was it.
Yeah.
And so, and the group SNCC by 1968 was tattered,
right.
and worn, had pushed the accelerator to the floor to get to 1968 in terms of, you know, the SNCC folk came out against the war against Vietnam, the Black Power, mm-hmm. then apartheid in South Africa, took on some of the critical issues around the world, even took a statement in support of Palestine, of the two-state kind of thing. And
right.
The
donors are gone.
yeah, donors gone. But also, you have about move the movement as far as you're going to be able to do without, because they're already arresting, they're already drafting, and so it's just a point where they kind of pick us off, And there are a lot of people who are just fatigued. You couldn't you couldn't go through this kind of intensity over a year without losing something. Mm. And it wasn't just your hair, it was your whole mindset. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and we recognize that. We recognize that almost instantly after Vietnam. But we take credit for Dr. King a year later, coming out against the war in Vietnam.
Right.
And we worked on it. We just talked to him. We talked about the moral character of the movement, and he had a moral obligation, if nothing else.
And there was a connection made on the Meredith March, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. There was a connection made on the Meredith March. But that connection always was there. Yeah. I think that the press and the status quo just felt like they had to create adversaries. And they saw SNCC and as that adversary. Mm-hmm. And you see on some of the historical film footage documentation, Stokely standing right next to Dr. King.
Right.
And they said that they didn't agree on some tactics. And they kept on marching together. They laughed and kept on down the road. But that's always the case. The difference between SNCC and SCLC, if you want to talk about organizational differences, is that SNCC believed in organizing, SCLC operated on mobilizing. Mm. So if they wanted to raise an issue, they would mobilize a march on Washington, they would mobilize the Selma to Montgomery.
Right.
And if SNCC wanted to have an issue on the right to vote and inclusion in the political process, they would organize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which is still semblance of that are still in existence in Mississippi today. Mm-hmm. Certainly at the beginning of the 90s or the mid-90s, there were more black elected officials in Mississippi than anywhere else in the world.
Right.
You know, so that would be the difference. And we recognize that. Mm-hmm. And SNCC had a real appreciation for many of the organizers in SCLC, James Orange and there were times when James Bevel would get out and could actually organize and mobilize students. But there were a number of people who had that kind of relationship. And Dr. King had a fondness for Willie Ricks, who was the person who actually kind of coined the phrase and said, Stokely, okay, here's our time. You need to go with this. He and Dr. King had a really, really, really interesting relationship. They were, Dr. King wanted to talk to somebody from SNCC, he'd call Willie Ricks. Willie Ricks wanted to go over and talk to Dr. King, he'd go over and walk right on in, through everybody back in the back into his office.
Yeah.
Say, hey, how you doing? I don't care what the circumstances were. He said, hey, Willie Ricks, how you doing? And that kind of relationship was the kind of standing relationship.
Right.
We had more time on the Mississippi Meredith March to kind of talk through that whole thing. And so whenever you have the time on a campaign, that's when you can let everything down and kind of, you know, just talk as human beings. In Alabama, we had some, in Selma, we had some conflicting, I think, ideas about the Selma to Montgomery March. We did not know that there had already been a strategy to develop between Dr. King and Lyndon Baines Johnson over the Voter Rights Act. If you can get this done, then we'll step in. But it came after the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Right.
And SNCC had already voted about a month before that they would not be involved in the Selma March. And John Lewis said that as an individual he wanted to march, which caused a lot of confusion and was the critical piece for John not getting elected the second time.
Right.
And so some of that is missed because the press intentionally misleads you. So when we got involved in it, after John went down, then SCLC wasn't ready to turn over any of the strategic kinds of notes to us. So when they went out and tried to redo the march, and they got on the other side of the bridge, I think, knelt down and turned around and came back, people felt betrayed. We didn't know that that was as far as he was supposed to go. But, you know, and so there began some antagonisms around that. Right. But that's just tactical antagonism. That's not personal antagonism.
Sure.
And some people chose to take things out of context in terms of, you know, we had discussions and talks, and we would say Deloitte, that would be Dr. King, or D. King, you know, and right. and people saw that as being demeaning.
Mm.
For us, it was amusing.
Sure.
And it was fantastic. We talked about, you know, the oratory and oratorical skills, and, you know, the Lord has shaken this earth again, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just got them going. And so people would hear that, reporters would hear that and saying, oh, they're being derogatory toward Dr. King. No, we were being very affectionate about Dr. King. Mm-hmm. And he knew. I mean, it wasn't a question that he didn't know. We say that to him.
Right.
You know.
Right.
The Lord has arrived.
And he would laugh?
He'd laugh and say, all right, now, you know, I don't like that kind of stuff. But that would be it.
Yeah.
And the other part of that is that sometimes people took that laughter as in some kind of way insulting or demeaning. But we always tried to find ways in which we could find something to laugh at. Because if you didn't, you'd be crying all the time. I mean, all the tragedies, all the disasters, all the things that are going on around you. So it was often, and it's in that laughter, you have, I mean, in that fun part of that, you would always say something that's comical about somebody else. You know, you say, Dr. King, after we went over to Philadelphia during the Mississippi Meredith March, and he got back in the car with Reverend Abernathy. Reverend Abernathy was supposed to say the prayer. And when he was saying the prayer, somebody standing behind him, because he was talking about, I pray for those sinners who kill my brothers, that peace be unto them. Somebody behind him said, and we're standing behind you. And Abernathy's eyes open up. So all the way back, Dr. King told him that Baptist preachers don't pray with their eyes open. And so that was a funny kind of joke. You know, it's truism. He said, well, what, were you scared? Oh, no, I wasn't scared. So I heard that man back there telling you that I was standing behind you. So you got a little worried there. You might even turn around and look back at him. Say, you were scared. That's what that was. And so everybody would fall out and laugh, you know,
right.
because, and it sounds like you're demeaning him by doing that kind of thing, but that was very common kind of posturing that would go on. It was harmless. It was not demeaning and vile and those kinds of things. And so you would find SCLC and Snickers using that kind of language and dialogue and discussion. We usually had very traditional kinds of lengths in communication, like, so I can't say what happens in a Mississippi with the staff, but when we went to Mississippi with the Mississippi Meredith March, we took essentially a staff that had been in Mississippi all the time. So we just facilitated that communication link, and once we did that, there were no problems at all. Absolutely none. We had an opportunity to work with the organizers because they came in to help with the march going down the road. We had our own people over there to help with the march going down the road. Dr. King started staying out at night in those respites, and he actually left sometimes to go and try to raise some money, and we weren't opposed to that because those funds were going to help us have a successful march in Mississippi.
Right. Right.
But he was there most of the time, and he was open, and you could see that sometimes he was embarrassed about the celebrity
right.
that he represented. And, I mean, people were, he was humble, and people were very kind of supportive, and it was a a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to actually see him up close. And so they would, you know, let me wash your feet, let me kiss your feet, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that made him feel very uneasy. So we would try to slide in and say, hey, look, if you have an orange or an apple, give it to him and we'll put it aside for him. If you have some water, you know, cold water, we'll give him a cup of water. Just, you know, pull the cup in. If you want us to take the jar, right, we'll take the jar. And, but said, you can go up and you can actually see him and shake his hand. You know, if you have to touch him, pat him on the shoulder or something. But we're going. We got to go, so we can't be here long.
Right.
And people felt very good about having that opportunity. They know what to do. You know, this is out of their biblical reading, you know, where the Messiah, and see, when I use that term, it for me, it's kind of comical, mm-hmm, but it has the same kind of biblical reference. The Messiah showed up, and I had a chance to touch the hem of his garment. And people remembered that throughout their lives, yeah, about the fact that even though they were way down in lowly Mississippi, and they were really struggling and suffering, that there was still hope that a Dr. King would actually come down and say hello to them. Because mm-hmm, that's what they saw. You know, he was there in a group, and it was a lot of other people, local people around, but it was them that he came, yeah, to see, you know.
Wow.
And it was him that they saw. Right. And so that was the way that is. So we continued to roll after that period of time because it became very obvious that COINTELPRO was in full operation, so mm-hmm, you had to steer clear of all of that. And then we had to find a way to keep Stokely alive, mm-hmm, as best we could. And so there were security precautions and different kinds of things we would use for that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to make sure that we had a clear message, a singular message. And because after a while, when John was defeated by Stokely,
mm-hmm,
John went out with another message about SNCC being off message now.
Right.
So we had to make sure that the message inside SNCC was consistent.
Yeah.
And we tried to do that. And then we had a situation where a group of people on what was called the Atlanta Project decided to articulate for SNCC what Black Power meant. And it was, if you read that statement, which was never approved, that statement was never entered as an agenda item in a SNCC meeting, but it was sent to the New York Times, and the New York Times published it as an official position. Mm. And then we are fighting now to certainly really keep control of the message.
Right.
And
right.
So we really kind of tightened down on that and try to ask people to refrain from having comments in that kind of fashion, that we'd have to go through the appropriate channels, mm-hmm, so that our message is clear, and so we're not drowned out, our voice is not drowned out, because we are actually pulling these pieces together as we go along. And mm-hmm, I told you that I go to California to meet with Cesar Chavez and the Great Pickers and,
oh, yeah,
bringing them into the fold, and then we go to Chicago and the Hispanic Puerto Rican, mm-hmm, community and the Puerto Rican independent movement. Stokely goes to Puerto Rico, mm-hmm, and then to Cuba, and so we are closing that gap. And then we go to South Dakota with the AIM and the American Indian Movement, and so we are fashioning all, yeah, of these associations and relationships,
right,
as we move further along. And And, you know, we got these people still bashing us over the head about we put white people out and all that kind of stuff. And I'm trying, my thing is that we don't want to even address that anymore. Let's address these other kinds of things in a meaningful manner. We don't have to do it through the press, but, bellicose and I forget their names, Means, and what's the other one's name? All a part of the American American Indian Movement. And from then on, every time we would have an activity, whatever it is, African Liberation Day or any of those kinds of things, we would ask the coalition to kind of come together and support that. If we had a position that we were coming out with, we wanted them to support that. If they had something going on, we were there to support those things. And then you get to about 1969 and everything kind of closes down and shuts down.
Right. Let me pause this real quick. Okay.